one simply couldn't make oneself king. You don't, if you have any sort of notion of divine right monarchy, you simply can't go around proclaiming yourself king or emperor, placing your brothers and family members on the thrones of states. You simply couldn't create states. What is this kingdom of Westphalia with its own new king? Also, Napoleon's insistence that his regime be based on a constitution was anathema to these other, to the crowned heads of Europe. This too seemed to be part of the Napoleonic, of the revolutionary heritage that Napoleon carried. And he had destroyed the legitimate government of France based on traditional privilege and the old social order. The new imperial aristocracy that received so much attention in France was, as we've seen, based on talent and service and not on traditional lineages. The monarchs therefore saw in Napoleon a double threat. On the one hand, the expansion of French military might was a nightmare for Europe, but Napoleon used this new mass army for revolutionary purposes. On the one hand, his foreign policy continued a traditional Bourbon policy, that is, the natural frontiers of France, the expansion of France. So in that sense, the old geopolitical objectives of the Bourbon monarchy, which all of Europe understood, this wasn't acceptable, but this was understandable. This is what dynasties did. The purpose of a dynasty was to expand, to look for ways to enrich itself, and so on. That they understood. The geopolitical aspects of the Napoleonic Empire, they understood. But to create this empire with vassal states, with satellite states, and to revolutionize them, this was too much. Because wherever French armies traveled, they introduced the Napoleonic Code, they ended traditional privileges, and just as the armies of the French Revolution had done, they, as they put it, continued to spread the blessings of liberty, the blessings of the revolution to the rest of Europe. Thus, the Napoleonic Wars had about them an air of ideology as well as the old traditional geopolitics. The Napoleonic state was a renegade. He could marry whoever he wanted, but no amount of marriage to a Habsburg princess or to a Romanov princess was going to get around the fact that this was a renegade state usurping the legitimate authority of monarchy everywhere, and it was hated by all monarchic powers in Europe. As soon as there would be a chink in the armor, if Napoleon showed 1 ounce of weakness, then one could tell that the monarchies would come piling back into an alliance against him. This, of course, is exactly what the British crown was hoping for. However, the notion of popular sovereignty, which the Napoleonic regime endorsed, of power residing in the nation and the people, was a threat not only to the legitimate traditional powers, to legitimate authority in Europe, it would also be a problem for the Grand Empire itself. The advance of French armies and their occupation of territory in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, led to the growth of nationalist sentiments in all of those areas of Europe. Nationalist sentiments, not so much in the masses, we're not talking about grassroots, popular nationalism, but among the university-educated elites of bourgeois elites in northern Italy, in Germany, and certainly in Spain, one sees the flowering of a new kind of nationalism, a nationalism that expresses itself in opposition to the occupation by French armies. So that when, for example, between 1805 and 1813, Wellington and the British want to use Spain as a springboard for their assault on the Napoleonic Empire, they are able to count on a great deal of propagandistic support from a kind of intellectual elite in Spain, talking about Spanish nationalism, the need for Spanish liberation, and so on. In this sense, the Napoleonic regime does bring nationalism, modern nationalism, to beyond the frontiers of France, and certainly complicates the international situation in this regard.